Ars and the entire plateau from the east. Khusro nodded. Then, noticing that the goblet which Belisarius was toying with in his hands was empty, began to gesture toward the servants standing a few yards away. But Belisarius waved down the offer. No more, please. He set the goblet down firmly on the small table next to his chair. I will send instructions to Rome ordering that cannons be brought to Babylon, along with a large supply of gunpowder. That much is in my authority. I will also, here he blew out his cheeks, strongly urge the Empress to give me permission to train your soldiers in their use. Khusro stroked his beard. Do you think she will agree? Possibly. She will insist, of course, that the cannons and gunpowder remain under the control of Roman troops. Still, they will be here, and then... Khusro's lips curled into a faint smile. Under the control of Roman troops, he murmured. Yes, yes. That has a nice, secure sound to it. For a moment, a Persian emperor and a Roman general stared at each other in silent conspiracy. Belisarius broke the silence with a little laugh. She's not naive, Emperor. Far from it. She will understand the inevitable results once lonely young Roman troops. He broke off, gazing into the distance. It's amazing, he mused, how many beautiful women you Aryans seem to produce. Khusro grinned. We are a comely folk. It cannot be denied. The grin faded. But you think the Emperor's regent will still agree? Belisarius nodded. It will be enough, I think, if Theodora can tell her suspicions that she didn't actually give the secrets outright. At least the damned Persians had to sweat for them. In the manner of speaking, chuckled Khusro. He planted his hands on his knees and rose to his feet. As always, the movement was quick and energetic. Speaking of beautiful Persian girls, he said, I have ordered a reception tonight in my pavilion, in honor of Marina's daughter, now married to one of your top commanders. She accompanied him here, I understand. Belisarius rose, nodding. Yes, she did. She insisted on it, apparently, much to Agathius's surprise. The Persian emperor began leading the way toward the pavilion. He cocked his head. Was he angry? Did he really believe all those tales about obedient Persian wives? Belisarius laughed. Actually, he was quite pleased. He's very taken by the girl, I think. It was not simply a marriage of ambition. Khusro smiled. Good. That bodes well for the future. Most auspicious, that wedding. I would like to see more of them. So would I, agreed Belisarius. As they walked slowly toward the pavilion, Khusro's smile turned a bit sly. That's part of the reason, of course. Well, actually, it is the reason that I commanded this little reception. Once my haughty nobles see the favor which their emperor bestows on such marriages, they'll find a daughter or two to marry off to some promising Roman officer. Oh, be sure of it. Be sure of it. We Aryans like to talk about the purity of our bloodlines, but we are by no means immune to ambition ourselves. He paused for a moment, struck by the sunset. Belisarius joined him in that admiration. It is a beautiful world, in truth, for all the evil in it. Let us never lose sight of that, Belisarius, however dark the future may seem. The emperor shook his head, glancing at the pavilion. Speaking of dark futures, and a near one at that, my brother Ormazd will be at the reception. He scowled fiercely. I will have to be polite to him, of course. In the end, he did not quite disobey me. Belisarius snorted. It was amazing, actually, how quickly he made his decision. Once Berestminus and I showed up at his camp outside Ctesiphon with almost 20,000 troops and the aura of our victory at Anatha, he didn't even dawdle during the march here. I should think not, snarled the emperor. He had a lot of face-saving to do. The Roman general's smile faded. Belisarius turned to face Khusro, his gaze intent. He said nothing. There was no need to explain. Not with this emperor. Khusro sighed. Yes, Belisarius, I agree. You have my permission to implement your plan. Belisarius hesitated. Do you understand? Did Berestminus explain it to you fully? At the end, Khusro made a short, chopping gesture with his hand. Yes, I understand. I will have to trust you. I will give you my oath if you so desire. The Emperor laughed now quite cheerfully. Nonsense, I don't want your oath. I want those two bodyguards of yours. That is their permanent duty? Belisarius nodded. Khusro took the general by the arm and resumed their progress toward the pavilion. His stride was no longer the leisurely amble of a man enjoying the sunset. It was the determined pace of a decisive man who had made up his mind. Good, he announced. They will be at the reception then. I will want to meet with them privately. Belisarius's eyes widened. Privately? With Valentinian and Anastasius? Whatever for? I want their oath. To keep you safe and alive at all costs. He eyed the general. Even if that means binding you with ropes and hitting you over the head to keep you from any more of the cavalry charges for which you have become quite famous, among my Dagons, no less. The Emperor shook his head. Any general who can impress Dagons with his heroism and disregard for personal safety needs close supervision, strict supervision. They were almost at the pavilion now. That Anastasius fellow, is he the gigantic one? Belisarius nodded. Khusro stopped at the pavilion's entrance, eyeing the general up and down, much like a man estimating livestock. Yes, yes, he murmured. He should have no difficulty, even if it comes to shackling you. He turned and strode within, and called over his shoulder, I will have his oath on it. Anastasius kept a straight face. Valentinian didn't even try. In the name of God and his son Jesus Christ, they concluded simultaneously. The solemnity of the occasion was undermined, of course, by the fact that Valentinian was grinning from ear to ear. But Khusro didn't seem dissatisfied with the result, judging from his own smiling face. Excellent, he pronounced. Anastasius and Valentinian took that as their cue. A moment later, bowing respectfully, they backed through the silk curtains which separated Khusro's private quarters from the main area of the imperial pavilion. A little frown came to the emperor's brow. He cocked his head toward Belisarius. What did he say? The smaller one. He muttered something on the way out. Belisarius smiled. I think he said, God bless wise emperors. But perhaps I misunderstood. Perhaps he said, nonsense, exclaimed Khusro. I'm quite sure that's what he said. He took Belisarius by the arm and began leading him out. Excellent fellow. Marvelous. Marvelous. Even if he does look like a vicious weasel. Belisarius kept his own counsel. Aid did not. I agree. Excellent fellow. And Anastasius. Try to be philosophical about the whole thing, Belisarius. Perhaps you could ask Anastasius to quote some appropriate words from Marcus Aurelius, or... What was that? You muttered something in your mind. Chapter 26 The Euphrates. And the charges are laid? Asked Belisarius. All of them? Seeing the hesitation on Basil's face, the general sighed. Don't tell me. You laid as many as you could using the captured Malwa gunpowder, but you didn't use any of our own. Basil nodded. His eyes avoided the general's. Belisarius restrained his angry outburst. He reminded himself firmly that he had chosen Basil to command the Katyusha rocket force because the man was one of the few Thracian cataphracts who had a liking and affinity for the new weapons. It was hardly surprising, therefore, that he would be unwilling to dismantle them. Finish the job, Basil, he rasped. I don't care if you have to use every single pound of gunpowder in our supply train, even if that includes emptying the Katyusha rockets themselves. Finish the job. Basil opened his mouth, closed it. Yes, sir, he said glumly. Belisarius resumed his study of the work which Basil had overseen in his absence. After a minute or so, he found that his ill temper with the man had quite vanished. In truth, except for his understandable reluctance to disarm his cherished rockets, Basil had done an excellent job. There was not much left now of the great dam which had formerly sealed off the Nahar Malka from the Euphrates. With the exception of a thin wall barely strong enough to withstand the river's pressure, A vast pile of stones had been removed and mounted up on the north bank of the canal. Already a thin trickle of water was seeping through, creating a small creek in what had been the dry bed of the former Royal Canal. Back-breaking work that must have been, he thought. Most of it, of course, was done by the Kushan captives. He cocked his head at Basil. Did they complain? The Kushans, I mean. Basil shook his head. Never the once. They didn't even try to shirk the work. Not much, anyway. No more than our own boys did. Belisarius grunted with satisfaction. Here, at least, Basil had apparently followed his instructions to the letter. What rotation did you use? 3-1? For the first week, was Basil's reply. After that, I went to 1-1. Belisarius's eyes widened. Wasn't that a bit risky? I don't think so, General. The Katyusha commander glanced at Belisarius, gauging his temper, before adding, I thought about the way you handled the surrender, sir. Then, after the first week, I talked to Vasudeva. He gave me his oath that the Kushans would not try an uprising. The cataphract smiled. Actually, it was he who insisted that we maintain half our troops on guard duty while the other half pitched into the work. After he gave me his oath, I was going to just keep a token force on patrol, but Vasudeva... Belisarius laughed and clapped his hands. He said it would be too insulting. Basil nodded. Belisarius's usual good humor had completely returned. He placed an approving hand on the cataphract's shoulder. Nice work, Basil. Again, Basil eyed the general, gauging his mood. He opened his mouth to speak, but Belisarius cut him off with a shake of the head. Not an angry headshake, but a firm one, nonetheless. No, Basil, I won't reconsider. It may well be that the Malwa gunpowder alone would do the trick, but I'm not going to take the chance. I want that dam to rupture instantly and completely. He turned to face his subordinate squarely. Think it through, Basil. If the charges are insufficient and we wind up with a half-demolished dam, what then? You know as well as I do that it would be a nightmare to set new charges with half the river pouring through. Take days, probably, not to mention the lives it would cost. In the meantime, the Malwa down at Babylon would have those same days to try and salvage their fleet. If the Euphrates dropped slowly, they could probably get most of their ships downriver to safety before they ground. They could certainly get the ships far enough from Babylon that Khosrow couldn't strike at them. He didn't raise his voice, not in the least, but his tone was like iron. I want that fleet grounded instantly, Basil. I want the Euphrates to drop so fast that the Malwa are caught completely off guard. Basil took a deep breath, nodded. Again, Belisarius clapped him on the shoulder. Besides, man, cheer up. We should be getting a new supply of gunpowder and rockets from Callinicum. Good Roman powder and rockets, too, not that Malwa crap. A big supply. I sent orders calling for every pound of gunpowder available. We've got more demolition work ahead of us. Lots more. Basil grimaced. Belisarius, understanding that grimace, made a little mental wince of his own. I hope. If the usual screw-ups with logistics aren't worse than normal. But there was no point in brooding on that matter, so he changed the subject. What's your opinion on security? He asked. Basil's face cleared up instantly. It's beautiful, sir. Between Abu and our scouts, and Karush and his Persians, I don't think a lizard could get within 10 miles of here without being spotted. From their vantage point on top of what remained of the ancient dam, the cataphract pointed down at the Nehar Malka. The Malwa have no idea what we're doing here, I'm sure of it. The one thing I was worried about was that the Kushans might try to sneak out a few of their men to warn the Malwa down at Babylon. No way to do that in the daytime, of course, but I had Abu maintain full patrols at night, and he swears, that no Kushan ever tried to— No, interrupted Belisarius, shaking his head firmly. That wouldn't be something the Kushans would do. Basil's brow creased in a frown. Why not? Vasudeva's oath was that they wouldn't try a rebellion or a mass breakout. He never swore that he wouldn't send a few men to report back. Belisarius looked away. It was his turn to hesitate now. He was as certain of his understanding of the Kushans as he was of anything in the world. But to explain it to Basil would require... Aid broke through the quandary. Tell him. Belisarius almost started. You're sure of this, Aid? Tell him. As much, at least, as you need to. It will not matter, Belisarius. Even if he talks, so what? By now, Link will have deduced my presence in this world. At the very least, it will do so very soon. Much sooner than any loose talk among Roman troops could ever find its way to the ears of Malwa spies. Secrecy about me is not so important anymore. Not as important, certainly, as the trust of your subordinate officers. Belisarius sighed with immense relief. He had always believed that his success as a general, as much as anything, rested on his ability to build a team around him. The need to keep Aide's presence a secret had cut across his most basic nature and instincts as a leader. He was glad to be done with it. Of course, came the firm thought, that doesn't mean you have to turn into a babbling babe. Belisarius, smiling, turned back to the cataphract standing next to him. I am sometimes blessed with visions of the future, Basil. The Thracian soldier's eyes widened. But not much, Belisarius noted. You're not surprised? Basil shrugged. No, sir, not really. Nobody talks, mind you, but I'm not stupid. I've noticed how Morris and Valentinian and Anastasius, for that matter, get very close-mouthed about certain things. Like exactly how you got the secret of gunpowder from the Malwa, and somehow managed to get it to Antonina in time for her to build a whole secret little army in Syria before you even got back. And exactly what happened or didn't happen in India. And exactly how it was that you were so sure that the Malwa would be our enemy, but nobody else ever gave India more than two thoughts. And why did Michael of Macedonia wind up such a close friend of a general? And just exactly... Belisarius held up his hand, laughing. Enough! He glanced around. He and Basil were quite alone on top of the dam. The nearest Roman soldiers were the small cavalry escort waiting patiently at its base. No Persians could be seen in the vicinity, and there was nowhere to hide anyway except in the reeds which line the Euphrates. The nearest clump of such reeds was 30 yards away, much too distant for any eyes to see the small thing which Belisarius drew out of a pouch hanging from his neck. He kept Aide in his hands, sheltered from sight. Basil leaned over, awestruck. Michael of Macedonia brought this to me, said Belisarius softly, over 3 years ago now. He calls it the Talisman of God. It is so beautiful, whispered Basil. I've never seen anything so wondrous. It is a marvel. It is a messenger from the future who came to warn us of the Malwa danger. It did so by giving me a vision of the future which Malwa would bring to the world. He paused, letting Basil absorb the shimmering glory of the facets. Later, I will tell you all of what I saw in that future. Indeed, he hesitated. Aide spoke. Yes, it is time. I will tell all of you, all of the army commanders. It's time now. But for the moment, he spoke gently then for a few minutes, telling the cataphract Basil of the vision he had received once of a princess held in captivity by the Malwa, held for them by a Kushan vassal named Kungus. And he told how, in that future, the Kushan named Kungus had held his tongue when a Malwa lord had entered his chamber to take possession of his new concubine, had not warned the great lord that his new concubine was an assassin, and how that lord had died in that future because a Kushan had his own harsh concept of honor. And then he told of how, in the future which Belisarius had created, that same Kushan had held his tongue once again, held it and said nothing to his Malwa masters when he realized that the Romans were smuggling the girl out of captivity. And where is he today, this Kungus? Asked Basil. Belisarius slipped Aide back into his pouch. Today the Kushan named Kungus, along with all of his men, are the personal bodyguard of the Empress Shakuntala, the heir of Satavahana, rightful ruler of Great Andhra. Basil looked up, startled. His eyes flashed south, looking toward the distant encampment of the Kushan captives. You think? Belisarius shrugged. Who knows? Kungus is an unusual man. But in some things I believe all Kushans are much alike. They have their own notions of loyalty and duty. They are Malwa vassals and have served them faithfully. But I don't think they bear any great love for their masters. None at all, in fact. He turned away and began climbing down the dam. Most of all, he added over his shoulder, they have their own peculiar sense of humor. Very wry. Rather on the grim side, too. But they cherish it quite deeply. At the bottom of the slope, he waited for Basil to join him. Once he had done so, Belisarius grinned. I'm counting on that sense of humor, you see. The Grishans wouldn't warn the Malwa of what we're doing. God, no. It would spoil a great joke. That night, in the gloom of his little tent, Vasudeva leaned over and filled Belisarius's cup. Good wine, he said. Not enough, of course. The Persians are stingy, but good. Good. He and Belisarius drained their cups. Vasudeva smiled. We like to gamble, you know, so we have a great bet going. All the Kushans have taken sides. He shrugged modestly. We have not much to wager, of course, being war captives, but it's always the spirit of a wager which is exciting, not the stakes. He refilled Belisarius's cup. Again, he and the general drained their wine. When they lowered their cups, Belisarius stated, You're wagering over whether I will succeed in my plan to drain the Euphrates dry and leave the Malwa stranded at Babylon without supplies. Vasudeva sneered, waved his hand in a curt, dismissive little gesture. Bah! What Kushan would be so stupid as to bet on that? He refilled the cups again. Brought his own to his lips, but before drinking added with a little smile, No. No, Belisarius. We are betting on what you will do afterward. Belisarius managed to drain his cup without choking. Vasudeva's smile became a grin. Oh, yes, murmured the Kushan commander. That's the real question. He drained his own cup. Vasudeva held up the amphora in a questioning gesture. Belisarius shook his head, placing his hand over his cup. No, thank you. I've had enough. Tomorrow will be a busy day. As he stoppered the wine jug, Vasudeva grimaced. Please. We will be doing most of the busyness, and in that miserable sun. Belisarius rose, stooping in the low shelter provided by the simple tent. Vasudeva rose with him. Much shorter, he didn't need to stoop. The Kushan's little smile returned. Still, that's the way it is. Really good jokes always take a lot of work. Outside the tent in the quiet air of the Kushan encampment, Valentinian and Anastasius were waiting with the horses. Quickly, Belisarius mounted. Vasudeva had come out of his tent to see the Roman general off. From other tents nearby, Belisarius could see other Kushans watching. For a moment, he and the Kushan commander stared at each other. Why did you come tonight, Belisarius? Asked Vasudeva suddenly. You asked me nothing. The general smiled very crookedly. There was no need, Vasudeva. I simply wanted to know if Kushans still had their sense of humor. Vasudeva didn't match that smile with one of his own. In the moonlit darkness, his hard face grew harder still. It is all that is left to us, Roman. When men have little, they keep what they have in a tight fist. Belisarius nodded. He clucked his horse into motion. Valentinian and Anastasius followed on their own mounts, trailing a few yards behind. Yes, they do, he murmured softly to himself. Yes, they do. Until finally, when they have nothing left, they realize. His words trailed into a mutter. What did he say? Whispered Anastasius, leaning over his saddle. Valentinian's face was sour. He said that damn stupid business about only the soul mattering in the end. Quite right, said Anastasius, approvingly. Then, spotting Valentinian's expression, the giant added, You know, if you ever get tired of being a soldier, I'm sure you could make a good living as a miracle worker, turning wine into vinegar. Valentinian began muttering now, but Anastasius ignored him blithely. I thought it was a good joke, he said. Mutter, mutter, mutter. A sense of humor's very important, Valentinian. Mutter, mutter, mutter. Wine into vinegar, yes. Yes, and then the possibilities are endless. Turn fresh milk sour, make puppies grim, kittens indolent. Oh, yes, Valentinian of Thrace, they'll be calling you, the miracle worker. Everybody will avoid you like the plague, of course. Probably be entire villages chasing you with stones, even, but you'll be famous. I'll be able to say, I knew him when he was just a simple, nasty, ill-tempered, disgruntled soldier. Oh, yes, I'll be able... Mutter, mutter, mutter. Early the next morning, construction began on the second phase of Belisarius's plan. The Roman soldiers played more of a role now than they had earlier. Undermining the old canal, except for the work of laying the charges, had been simple and uncomplicated work. Brutal work, of course, hauling an enormous quantity of stones out of a canal bed, but simple. This new project was not. Belisarius oversaw the work from a tower which his troops erected on the left bank of the Euphrates, just below the place where the Nahal Malka branched off to the east. The tower was sturdy, but otherwise crude. Nothing more than a 20-foot-high wooden framework which supported a small platform at the top. The platform was 6 feet square, surrounded by a low railing, and sheltered from the sun by a canopy. Access to it was by means of a ladder built directly onto the framework. There was only room on that platform to fit 3 or 4 men comfortably. Belisarius and Burasminus, who occupied the platform alone that first day, had ample room. The Roman general drew the Sauteron's attention to the work below. They're about to place the first pontoon. Burasminus leaned over the rail. Below, he could see Roman soldiers guiding a small barge down the Euphrates. The barge was the standard type of river craft used in Mesopotamia and throughout the region, but Egyptians called a scaphe. It was 50 feet long by 16 feet wide, with a prow so blunt it was almost shaped like the stern. The craft could be either rowed or sailed. The only thing unusual about this barge was that the mast had been braced and the sails were made of wicker, useless for catching the wind, but excellent for securing the baskets of stones which would eventually be laid against them. A squad of soldiers were on the barge itself, shouting orders to the mass of soldiers who were doing the actual work of placing the barge. Many of those soldiers were on the riverbank, holding onto the barge by means of long ropes. Others were on the 2 barges which were serving as tugs, one directly behind, helping to hold the barge against the sluggish current, the other in mid-river, counteracting with its own ropes the pull of the soldiers on land. Surprisingly quickly, the barge was brought into location about 30 yards from the riverbank. The barge was facing upstream, its bow heading into the current. The craft was riding very low in the water. From their vantage point, Belisarius and Burasminus could see the stones in the hull which weighted down the craft to the point where it was almost already submerged. The soldier in charge looked up at Belisarius. The general waved his hand, indicating that he was satisfied with the positioning. Immediately, 2 of the soldiers on the barge clambered down into the hull. Belisarius and Burasminus could hear the hammering sounds as the soldiers knocked loose the scuttling pins. A minute or so later, the soldiers reappeared. The entire squad, except for their commander, clambered aboard a small boat tied alongside the barge. They attached the boat to a rope from the tub directly astern, and then released the rest of the ropes coming from that tug. The barge was now settling below the river's surface. The squad commander quickly climbed up a ladder to the top of the barge's mast. There he remained, watching carefully as the barge sank into the river, ready to issue commands if the current moved it out of location. Not until the water was lapping at his feet did the squad commander climb into the small boat alongside. A moment later, the only thing visible was the upper 3 feet of the mast. The barge was securely grounded on the riverbed. "That's the first one," announced Belisarius. "Well done, that was." Already another barge was being jockeyed into position next to the first. Burasminus, watching, was struck by the speed with which the Romans scuttled that craft next to the first, further into the river's main course, and the next, and the next. The Sauteron said nothing, but he was deeply impressed. Persians had often matched Roman armies on the battlefield, outmatched them as often as not. But no people on the face of the earth had that uncanny Roman skill with field fortifications and combat engineering. "Will you have enough barges?" he asked toward the end of the day. By then, 11 pontoons had been sunk. Belisarius shrugged. "I think so. The supplies are coming from Callinicum steadily now. Since there's nothing to send back on those barges, I can use almost all of them for pontoons." He smiled, remembering the look of relief on Basil's face when the supply barges which had arrived the day before proved to be carrying an ample supply of gunpowder to refurbish his rocket force. refurbish it, and more. New stocks of rockets had also arrived, along with three more Katyushas and the crews to man them. Belisarius glanced toward the west. The sun was almost touching the horizon. He decided there wouldn't be enough daylight to position another pontoon, and he didn't want to risk his men's lives in a night operation unless it was critical. For all the relaxed ease with which his soldiers went about their task, it was dangerous work. So he leaned over the rail and shouted the order to quit for the day. His squad commanders, familiar with their general's attitudes, were obviously anticipating the order. The oncoming barge was gently grounded on the riverbank, where it could easily be pushed off the next morning. On the third day, Belisarius shifted his operations to the other side of the river, where a similar command tower had been erected. While Morris oversaw the work on the left bank, Belisarius started the process of extending a line of pontoons from the west. By the fifth day, the operation was in full swing. The Euphrates, at that point, was a shallow but very broad river, almost a mile wide. Sinking 20 to 25 pontoons a day, the Roman engineers were building their dam at the rate which would, theoretically, bridge the river within a fortnight. Of course, the rate at which the pontoons were sunk began slowing. As the dam took shape, the current became faster, and, what was worse, turbulent. Two men were killed on the eighth day. After knocking loose the scuttling pins, they failed to emerge from the hold quickly enough. What happened? No one knew, or ever would. Probably one of them had slipped and the other had gone to his aid. But there was no time now for anything but haste. The river which poured into the settling hull was not the sluggish stream it had been. The water hammered into the barge and drove it down like a pile driver. Days later, one of the bodies floated loose and was salvaged downstream. By the end of the second week, the Euphrates was a snarling beast. As the Roman engineers extended the two lines of pontoons closer and closer to each other, the center of the river became a thundering torrent of water. The rest wasn't much better. As the water level rose behind the dam, the entire Euphrates became a cataract, pouring over the line of pontoons all across its width. Casualties were now occurring daily, a matter of broken limbs and crushed fingers for the most part, but there were fatalities also. On the 12th day, the entire crew of a pontoon perished when they lost control of the barge just at the point when they were preparing to scuttle it. The heavily weighted craft was swept into the narrow channel in the center of the river. Before it was halfway through, the barge disintegrated, spilling its men into the torrent. Most of them were dead by the time their bodies were recovered. One man survived for half a day, his skull shattered and pulpy before he finally expired. The Roman troops had the worst of it, since they were doing the most dangerous part of the job, but those were not happy days for the Kushans either. Behind the Roman engineers extending the pontoons, the Kushans were set to work building the dam higher. Using their own barges, the captives hauled baskets full of stones and dropped them onto the submerged pontoons. The current piled the heavy baskets up against the wicker sails. The strain on those sunken masts and spars would probably have broken some of them, except that the Romans had lashed the masts together as they extended the line of pontoons. Most of the Kushans, however, were engaged elsewhere. The stones used to bolster the dam had to be hauled out of the surrounding landscape. Fortunately, there were many stones to be found within a mile of the river. Mesopotamia had been farmed for millennia, but the topsoil was constantly being blown away, and annual plowing brought up another layer of stones. These stones, as the centuries passed, were piled at the center or edges of fields. So there was no lack of stones, and none of them had to be dug up out of the soil. But it was still hard work for the Kushans, loading sledges and dragging them to the river. At first, the Kushans were disgruntled. Crazy Roman. Why doesn't the stupid bastard use the stones we already dug out of the Naharmalka? Look, there's a giant pile of the things, not 300 yards away. Whoever made this idiot a general anyway? As the days passed, however, the Kushans began to realize that the Cretan Roman general apparently had other plans for those stones. What those plans were, the Kushans didn't know. They were no longer permitted in the vicinity of the Naharmalka. But from a distance, they could catch glimpses of Roman engineers working around the enormous mound of rocks which the Kushans had piled on the north bank of the Naharmalka, digging tunnels, so it appeared. And they noted that the men involved in that work were the same Romans who manned the rocket chariots, gunpowder experts. The betting among the Kushan captives intensified. Kurush and his Persian soldiers were not involved in any of this work. Theirs was the task of ensuring the worksite's security. Every day, Kurush and his 10,000 Persian cavalrymen patrolled the region, extending their skirmishers to a distance of 30 miles in every direction. Abu and the Arab scouts accompanied them in this work, as did a small number of the Roman troops. On a rotating basis, two battalions of Belisarius's soldiers, one cavalry, one infantry, were assigned each day to assist the Persians. In truth, the assignment was more in the way of a relief than anything else. After the backbreaking and risky work of building the dam, every Roman soldier looked forward to a day spent in a leisurely march. Finally, on the 19th day, the last pontoon was maneuvered into place and scuttled. The Romans took 4 days' well-deserved rest, while the Kushans finished the job of bolstering the pontoon with baskets of stones. It was done. 23 days' work had turned that strip of the Euphrates into a waterfall. A low waterfall, to be sure, but it was impressive nonetheless. The Roman troops and the Kushan captives spent the 24th day in a cheerful celebration, lining the banks and getting drunk, while they admired the raging cataract which they had built. At Belisarius's order, the wine ration was very generous, as much for the Kushans as the Romans. A Malwa officer, had there been one present to notice, would have been outraged at the free and easy fraternization between captives and captors. Belisarius and his top officers, however, did not join in the revelry. They spent that entire day in the general's command tent. The first 2 hours of that day were taken up with Belisarius's immediate plans. The rest was given to awe and mystery and wonder. As he had promised Basil, Belisarius brought his entire command into the secret. He told them the secret first using his own words. Then, when he was done, brought forth the talisman of God. Aid was prepared. The coruscating colors which filled the command tent were so dazzling that they caused the leather walls to glow. Roman soldiers who saw from outside the tent whispered among themselves. Witchcraft, muttered a few, but most simply shrugged the thing off. Belisarius was unique, a blessed man. Hadn't Michael of Macedonia himself said so? So why shouldn't his tent glow in daylight? Kushans also noticed and discussed the matter. Here the opinion was unanimous. Sorcery. The Roman general was a witch. It was obvious. Obvious. The wagering became feverish. When evening fell, Belisarius's officers filed quietly out of his tent. None of them said a word except Agathias. As the commander of the Greek cataphracts passed by Belisarius, he whispered, "We will not fail you, general. This I swear." Belisarius inclined his head. A moment later, only Morris was left in the tent.
"When?" asked the Thracian Kiliarch.
"How soon can you reach Babylon? A week?"
"Be serious," growled Morris. "Do I look like a puling babe?"
Belisarius smiled.
4 days, grunted Morris. 3 to get there, and a day for Khusrow to make ready.
5 days, counted Belisarius.
Khusrow should be ready, but an extra day may help. Besides, you never know. You might fall off your horse.
Morris disdained any reply. Early the next morning, Morris left. He was accompanied by 100 of his Thracian cataphracts, as well as a squad of Arab scouts. At the same time, one of Kurush's top officers, Marina himself, in fact, led a similar expedition to Ctesiphon. Their purpose was to bring warning to the residents of the capital. The next 4 days, Belisarius spent overseeing the final preparations at the Nahar Malka. None of the Roman troops, except Basil and his men, were engaged in this work, however, so they spent those days resting. By late afternoon of the 5th day, the entire allied force was thronging the banks of the Euphrates. Over 20,000 men, Romans, Persians, Kushan captives, were jostling each other for a vantage point. Belisarius had to use his bucellarii to keep the onlookers from piling too close to the Nahar Malka. The general himself was standing atop the command tower. He was joined there by Barasmanus and Kurush.
"You should not have made the announcement," fretted Kurush. "It was impossible to keep the security patrols out beyond noon."
Belisarius shrugged.
"And so? By the time a spy reaches the Malwa with the news, they will know already."
He leaned over the rail. Below him, standing at the base of the tower, Basil looked up. The Katyusha commander held a burning slow match in his hand. Belisarius began to give the order to light the fuse, then hesitated.
"New times," he murmured. "New times need new traditions. Light the fuse just won't do."
He sent a thought inward. "Aid?" The reply came instantly.
"Fire in the hole."
Belisarius grinned, leaned over.
"Fire in the hole!"
Basil needed no translation. A moment later, the fuse was burning. As it hissed its furious way toward the last barrier across the Nahar Malka, Basil began capering like a child.
"I like that! I like that!" he cried.
"Fire in the hole!"
The cry was taken up by others. Within 3 minutes, the entire army was chanting the words. Even the Kushans in their newly learned and broken Greek.
"Fire in the hole! Fire in the hole!"
The fuse reached its destination. There was fire in the hole. Chapter 27. The demolition had been well planned. So much was immediately obvious. Guided by aid, Belisarius and Basil had emplaced the charges in the optimum locations to do the job. Across most of its width, the lower bank of the dam blew sidewise, clearing an instant path for the pent-up energy of the Euphrates. The great river, now released, literally burst into the new channel open for it. Raging like a bull, the torrent charged down the long, dry Nahar Malka, scouring it deeper and wider as it went. But Belisarius was unable to appreciate the sight. As so often happens in life, practice subverted theory. The charges had been perfectly placed, true, and then doubled beyond Aid's instructions, and then doubled again. Aid had complained, of course, had warned, cautioned, chastened, chastised, been driven, in fact, into its own crystalline version of a gibbering fit. To no avail. With the simple logic of men whose familiarity with gunpowder was still primitive, Belisarius and Basil had both insisted that more was vastly preferable than enough. Better to make sure the job was done, after all, than to risk a feeble half-result through cringing niggardliness. Applied to the task of splitting a log with an axe, such logic simply results in unnecessary exertion. Applied to the task of demolishing a dam with gunpowder, however,
"I told you so," groused Aid, as Belisarius watched the top layers of the dam sailing into the sky. Hundreds upon hundreds of rocks and boulders, tons and tons of stony projectiles soaring every which way. Not all of those missiles, of course, were heading for the tower where Belisarius stood. It just seemed that way.
Berestimus and Carouche scrambled down the ladder first. The Roman general was halfway down,
stupid humans,
when the first rocks began pelting into the tower. By the time he was three-fourths down,
protoplasmic idiots,
covered now with wood splinters,
glorified monkeys,
the tower collapsed completely. That probably saved his life, as well as those of Berestimus and Carouche, and Basil, who had also instinctively sought shelter beneath the tower. The half-shattered platform hammered Belisarius and the other three men into the ground, battering them almost senseless. Thereafter, however, it acted as a sort of huge shield, sheltering them, in a manner of speaking, from the hail of rocks which would otherwise have turned two Roman officers and two Persian noblemen into so much undifferentiated pulp. At the time, Belisarius found little comfort in the fact. The platform lying on him did not deflect the blows in the manner of a true shield so much as it simply spread the shock across his entire body. He was not pulped, therefore. Amazingly, none of his bones were even broken. But he did undergo a version of being pounded into flatcake, except that flatcakes do not suffer the added indignity of being lectured throughout the experience.
Crazy fucking Thracian.
Whoever made you a general, anyway? It's amazing you even made it out of the womb, as stupid as you are. I'm surprised you didn't insist on finding your own way out. God forbid you should listen to your mother.
Crazy fucking Thracian.
Whoever,
and so on, and so forth.
It took his soldiers an hour to dig Belisarius and the others out after the rock stopped falling.
The digging itself actually took only a few minutes. The delay was caused by the fact that his men had fled a full half mile away after the barrage started. His first semi-conscious croaking words.
Did it work? I couldn't see.
His ensuing croaks, after being assured of full success in the project.
Next time, smaller charges.
Much smaller,
croaked Basil.
Crazy fucking Romans, croaked Barasminus.
Whoever put him in charge,
croaked Carouche. Others also failed to heed warnings.
When Marina arrived at Ctesiphon to warn the governor of the oncoming tidal wave, the man responded with derision.
Partly that was due to his personality. Arrogant by nature, his recent naming to the post of Shahrab of the Persian Empire's capital city had swelled his head even further. In the main, however, his attitude was determined by politics. The Shahrab of Ctesiphon, Sharaway was his name, was allied with Ormazd's faction. The appearance before him of an officer of Emperor Khusro's most ferociously loyal follower, Barasminus, seemed to him a perfect opportunity to score a political point. So, Sharaway responded to Marina's warning with jocular remarks on lunacy, embellished with denunciations of Romans and those Persians besotted with them, and concluding with a not-so-veiled thrust on the subject of miscegenation. Marina's men had to restrain him. After the unfortunate session, once Marina had calmed down enough to think clearly, he ordered his men to take informal and unofficial warnings to the boatmen plying their trade on the Tigris. As best they could, given their relatively small numbers, his soldiers tried to warn the city's fishermen and boat captains. Approximately half of the men they were able to speak to heeded their warnings. The other half, as well as all the men they were unable to reach in time, did not. When the tidal wave arrived 2 days later, the destruction of property was immense. Few lives were lost, however. By the time the newly released waters of the Euphrates reached Ctesiphon, they took the form of a sudden 5-foot-high surge in elevation, rather than an actual wall of water. Most of the men caught in the river had time to scramble or swim to safety, but their boats, as well as a multitude of shore-lining structures, were pounded into splinters. Sharaway's prestige plummeted, and with it the allegiance of most of his military retainers. The huge mob of enraged and impoverished boatmen whom Marina and his soldiers led to the Shahrab's palace poured over the few guards still willing to defend their lord. Sharaway was dragged out, weighted down with chains, and pitched into the newly risen Tigris. In those changed and raging waters, he vanished without a trace. In Babylon, on the other hand, everything went smoothly and according to plan. Khusro had been preparing for this moment for weeks. The 2 days' warning which Morris gave him were almost unnecessary. Belisarius had deliberately blown the dam in the late afternoon, calculating that the effects of the river's diversion would thereby strike Babylon the following morning. That would give Emperor Khusro a full day in which to take advantage of the new situation. His calculations, of course, were extremely crude. Simply an estimate of the river's current divided into an estimate of the distance between Nahar Malka and Babylon. In the event, Belisarius's guess was off by several hours. He had failed to make sufficient allowance for the fact that the current would ebb once the built-up pressure of the backwater dropped. So it was not until noon of the next day that the effects of his work made themselves felt. The difference was moot. The Persian emperor's confidence in the Roman general was so great that he had decided to launch the attack at daybreak, whether or not the river level had dropped. It was a wise decision. As always, getting a major result underway took more time than planned. Much more time in this instance. The Persian troops, lacking the Roman expertise in engineering fieldcraft, required several hours to bring into position and ready the improvised pontoons which they would use to cross the Euphrates. By then, alerted by the slowly unfolding work of Khusro's engineers, the Malwa had realized that the Persians were planning a sally across the Euphrates. But the foreknowledge did them no good at all. Quite the contrary. Lord Jivita, the Malwa High Commander, thought the Persian project was absurd. "What is the point of this?" he demanded, watching the Persian preparations from his own command tower. None of the half-dozen officers standing there with him made any reply. The question was clearly rhetorical, as were most of Jivita's queries. The High Commander's aides had long since learned that Jivita did not look kindly upon subordinates who provided their own answers to his questions.
Jivita pointed to the Persian troops massing on the left bank of the river, just below the great western wall of Babylon.
Madness, he decreed. Even if they succeed in crossing, what is there for them to do on the western side of the Euphrates?
He swept his arm. The gesture was simultaneously grandiose and dismissive.
There is nothing on that side except marshes and desert.
He slapped his hands together. No matter, they will not cross in any event. I see the opportunity here for a great victory. He turned to one of his officers, the subordinate in charge with the Malwa's fleet of war galleys. Jayanaga, send the entire flotilla forward. We will butcher the Persians as they try to cross. With a fierce glower, make sure your galleys do not fire their rockets until the enemy's lead elements are almost across. I want to make sure we catch as many of them as possible on their pitiful pontoons. Do you understand?
Jayanaga nodded and immediately left.
Lord Jivita turned back to his examination of the enemy. Again he clapped his hands with satisfaction.
We will butcher them.
Butcher them! The Malwa flotilla, 42 galleys in all, was almost within rocket range of the pontoon bridge when the captain of the lead ship realized that something was wrong. His first assumption, however, was far off the mark. He turned to the oarmaster.
Why have you slowed the tempo? He demanded.
The oarmaster immediately shook his head, pointing to the two men pounding on kettle drums.
I didn't. Listen, they're beating the right tempo.
The captain's scowl deepened. Before the oarmaster had even finished speaking, the captain realized that he was right. Still, the ship was slowing.
No, it was going backward.
Look, cried one of the other officers, pointing to the near bank. The river's dropping.
What? Impossible, not that fast.
The captain leaned over the railing, studying the shore. Within seconds, his face paled.
They've diverted the river upstream, he whispered.
It must be. Nothing else could...
He broke off, his attention drawn by the sound of hooves pounding on the wooden planks. Lots of hooves. Upstream, he could see Persian cavalry racing across the pontoon bridge. Dozens, hundreds, thousands of Persian lancers and armored archers were streaming over to the west bank of the Euphrates. Like his commander, Lord Jivita, the galley captain had been puzzled by the Persian sally. There had seemed no purpose for the enemy to cross the Euphrates, especially when the crossing itself would expose the Persians to withering rocket fire from the Malwa galleys. Who was there to fight on that side of the river? The great mass of the Malwa army was concentrated on the east bank, south of Babylon's fortifications. Now he understood. The captain was a quick-thinking man.
They knew about it ahead of time, he hissed. They're going to burn the supply ships.
He twisted, staring back at the huge mass of supply barges some half-mile south. Already he could see the unwieldy craft yawing out of control, driven by the rapidly ebbing waters of the river. Within a minute he knew they would start grounding. Helpless targets. Especially helpless when there would be no war galleys to protect them. His own flotilla would be grounded also, not as quickly, for they had a much shallower draft. Unless...
Row toward the center of the river, he roared. Signal the other ships to do likewise.
Immediately the drums began beating a new rhythm. The Malwa had no sophisticated signaling system for controlling their fleet. But the captain of the lead galley also served as the commodore of the flotilla. The message of the drums was simple. Do as I do. But it was already too late. The drums had barely begun beating when the flotilla commander saw the first of his warships ground. There was no dramatic splintering of wood. The bed of the Euphrates was mud, not rock. Just the sudden halting of the galley's motion, a slight tilt as it adjusted to the angle of the riverbed. Nothing dramatic, nothing spectacular, but the result was still deadly. Helpless targets. The captain felt his own galley lurch, heard the slight hissing of mud and sand against the wooden hull. His craft jerked loose. Another hiss, another lurch, jerked loose, stopped. A quick-thinking man. He wasted no time trying to pry the vessel out. The muddy soil of the riverbed would hold the hull like glue. Instead, he turned his attention to preparing his defenses.
Move the rocket troughs around, he bellowed. Set them to repel boarders.
His rocket handlers scurried to obey. One of them cried out, clutching his arm. An arrow was suddenly protruding from his elbow. The cry was cut short by another arrow penetrating his throat. The captain spun around.
To his despair, he saw that the enemy charging down the west bank had drawn parallel to his craft. Already the Persian lancers were guiding their mounts into the riverbed. Their pace was slow due to the thick mud and reeds, but the powerful Persian war horses were still driving forward relentlessly. They would cover the distance quickly enough. There would be no time to bring the rockets to bear, he knew, and there was no chance that his lightly armored sailors could withstand Persian Dagans in hand-to-hand combat. A quick-thinking man. He began to shout his surrender, but fell instantly silent hearing the war cry of the oncoming Persians. Karax! 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 He understood at once that there would be no surrender. No chance. He died 8 seconds later, struck down by an arrow which tore through his heart. He made no attempt to evade the missile. There would have been no point. The enemy arrows were like a flock of geese. Instead, he simply stood there silent, unmoving, presenting his chest to the enemy. When all was said and done, the quick-thinking man was Kshatriya. He would die so. The Persians who saw were impressed. Hours later, they retrieved his body, the charred remnants of it, from the burned hulk of his galley. They carried the corpse back into Babylon and gave it an honored resting place along with their own dead, perched in the Aryan way atop a stone tower called Dachma. There, exposed to carrion eaters, the unclean flesh would be stripped away, leaving the soul pure and intact. But that act of grace was yet to come. For now, the Persian cavalrymen thought only of slaughter and destruction. The Dagans and their archers rampaged down the west bank of the river for miles, destroying every ship within their reach. The huge Malwa army on the opposite shore could only watch in helpless fury. Malwa officers drove many of their soldiers into the riverbed in an attempt to rescue the stranded ships. But the mud and reeds impeded those troops, at least as much as they had the Persian lancers on the west bank, and the Malwa were far more distant. By the time the soldiers struggling through the muck could reach them, the ships would be nothing but burning wreckage. The Persians weren't able to destroy the entire fleet, of course. Many of the Malwa galleys and supply ships, whether through their own effort or good luck or both, wound up stranded on the east bank of the river. Those ships, protected by the nearby Malwa troops, were quite safe. They didn't even suffer much damage from the grounding itself due to the soft nature of the riverbed. But all of the ships which grounded within bow range of the Persians were doomed. Those close enough for the Persians to storm were burned by hand after their crews were massacred. Those too far into the center of the river to be stormed were simply burned with fire arrows. Those sailors who could swim survived. Those who could not, died. At sunset, the Persians broke off their sally and retreated back into Babylon. By the time the last Dagan trotted back across the pontoon bridge, almost a third of the Malwa fleet had been destroyed, along with most of the sailors who had manned those ships. Those sailors were only the least of the casualties which the Malwa suffered that day. An hour into the Persian sally, Lord Jivita ordered a mass assault against the walls of Babylon. The assault began almost immediately. His officers were terrified by his temper and was carried on throughout the rest of the afternoon. It is possible that Lord Jivita ordered the assault because he thought the Persian sally had emptied Babylon of most of its defenders. Possible, but unlikely. The Malwa espionage service had kept Jivita well informed of the enemy's strength throughout the siege. A simple count of the Persians across the river should have led the Malwa commander to the conclusion that Emperor Khusro had kept the big majority of his troops behind the city's walls. No, Lord Jivita's action was almost certainly the product of nothing more sophisticated than blind fury. The petulant, squalling rage of a thwarted child. A very spoiled child. The price was paid by his troops. Khusro had read his opponent's mentality quite accurately. The emperor had expected just such a mindless attack and had prepared his defenses accordingly. The Malwa soldiers crossing the no man's land were ravaged by his catapults and his archers, stymied by the moats and walls, butchered at the walls themselves by heavily armored Dagans for whom they were no match in close-quarter combat. The casualties were horrendous, especially among the Kushans who spearheaded most of the assaults. By the end of the day, when the attack was finally called off, 6,000 Malwa soldiers lay dead or dying on the field of battle. 13,000 had suffered injuries, from which, within a week, another 5,000 would die. In all, in that one day, the Malwa suffered over 20,000 casualties. Any other army in the world would have been broken by such losses, and even the Malwa army reeled. Lord Jivita himself didn't reel. His fury grew and grew as the hours passed. By sundown, his despairing officers realized Jivita was still determined to press the attack through the night. The abyss of total disaster yawned before them. They were pulled back from that pit by an old woman. When Great Lady Holy clambered painfully up the ladder onto the command tower, silence immediately fell over the small crowd of top officers packed there. Even Lord Jivita broke off his bellowing. The Great Lady cast only a glance at Jivita.
"You are relieved," she announced.
Her empty eyes moved to a figure standing next to Jivita.
"Lord Achyuta, you are now in command of the army."
Jivita's eyes bulged.
"You can't do that," he screeched. "Only the Emperor has the authority."
"Kill him," said Great Lady Holy.
The two guards stationed on the platform stiffened, hesitated, their eyes flashing back and forth between Holy and Jivita. He was their commander, after all. She was officially nothing but... nothing but. They had heard tales. All Malwa soldiers had heard tales. The Great Lady's eyes were now utterly barren. When she spoke again, her voice was inhuman, empty of all life.
"Kill him."
The guards had only heard tales, but the officers on that platform were all members of the Malwa dynastic clan. They knew the truth behind the tales. Lord Achyuta's sword was the first to slice into Jivita's belly, but only because he was standing the closest. Before Jivita slumped to the ground, five other swords had cut and sliced the life from his body. The two guards were still standing stiff and rigid. Great Lady Holy's vacant eyes fell upon them. If she hesitated at all, it was for less than a second.
"Kill them also. There must be no tales."
Pudgy, middle-aged generals